Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Every fishing boat in my world is a small business, and many times it's a family business.
Candidates in the governor's race share their goals for Alaska's seafood industry. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 4th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska state troopers seized more than 2 million doses of fentanyl this summer.
I'm confident in our efforts this past summer that we have absolutely saved Alaskan lives.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
A 15th person has died in Alaska Department of Corrections custody this year. 34-year-old William Ben Hensley III was pronounced dead Sunday at Goose Creek Correctional Center. He'd been in corrections custody for 1 month. No foul play is suspected, according to the department. A cause of death was not provided. It's the first time since 2015 that 15 people have died while jailed in Alaska in a single year. Several of the people who died this year had only been in custody for a short period of time. 2 people died in custody last week, one after 13 days in custody and one after 7 days. Kodiak's fisheries debates kicked off last night with 2 challengers in the governor's race, Les Guerra and Bill Walker. Current Governor Mike Dunleavy did not attend Monday's debate. KMXD's Kirsten Dobrath reports both candidates spent time deriding Dunleavy's policies and outlining their visions for fisheries management.
The need for more science to manage Alaska's fisheries came up early and often during Monday's debate. So did climate change. And both candidates say the current governor's budget has hamstrung the state's ability to do its own research on changing ocean conditions. Former governor and independent candidate Bill Walker.
One flight here, I sat next to a young lady that was a fishery research biologist for fishing game and was laid out because of budget cuts. We need the best available information in making the decisions. We need the best available research.
Democrat Les Guerra immediately ripped into Governor Dunleavy's budget cuts. He says the commercial fishing industry is just one area where Alaskans are suffering from the consequences.
We can't retain teachers. We can't retain police. I want a strong Department of Fish and Game that does studies. You know what a Department of Fish and Game commissioner does now? He testifies and talks about all the studies he's asked the feds to pay for.
Bycatch, which is the incidental catch of non-target species like salmon, also came up early and often. The governor created the Bycatch Review Task Force last year, but Guerra called it powerless.
And he put it together so that its recommendations would come out after the legislative session was over. So they couldn't do anything with it.
Guerra says picking the right people for Alaska's seats on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council is a better way to address the issue of bycatch. Walker also says the timing of the task force was convenient for the incumbent governor as he runs for re-election, but he'd keep it around if he were elected. He says the work the group is doing is important.
I like the idea of it being a year-round, not just, you know, it's going to expire in November. This issue is not going to expire in November.
Governor Dunleavy didn't attend Monday's fisheries debate, which is held in Kodiak every election year. He wasn't at the last one in 2018 either. The conversation between Walker and Guerra was amicable and at times lighthearted. Both candidates say they're tentatively in favor of hatcheries as long as they don't harm wild fish. They talked about the significance of the federal bipartisan infrastructure law and its potential to reinvigorate working waterfronts in coastal communities. Mariculture also came up. Walker says the industry could be a boon for Alaska, but it needs more support and investment. And he claims seaweed makes pretty good beer, too. Guerra says he'd favor small business loans for fishermen to get started in kelp farming.
I would like to do everything we can to expand this industry. It's a shoulder season industry. So if you're fishing in the summer, you can still do mariculture when you're not out fishing.
Both candidates were asked about their long-term visions for Alaska's seafood industry. Walker identified barriers to entry for new fishermen as one of the biggest challenges he sees for the industry.
Every fishing boat in my world is a small business, and many times it's a family business. And so I want to make sure that that is continued on and on for generations.
When asked who they would choose for Alaska's Fish and Game Commissioner, both Walker and Guerra said they want someone who is passionate and has management skills. Guerra says he's looking for someone who can talk fish.
It would be somebody who is not there or selected because of their politics, number one. I want them to be somebody who will make decisions based on science.
Monday's debate was the first of three fisheries debates in Kodiak, held over two nights. Congressional debates start tonight at 6:30. Kodiak Public Radio Station KMXT will stream the debates from its website. That's kmxt.org. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Acting State Revenue Commissioner Devin Mitchell has been chosen as the new Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. The announcement was made by the fund's board yesterday. Mitchell told the board he would not chase short-term cash yields as the fund has been invested for long-term growth. He also said he doesn't see the CEO's role as second-guessing or overriding investment decisions made by the corporation's chief investment officer. Last month, Mitchell stepped down as the state's debt manager and executive director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority when Governor Mike Dunleavy appointed him to be the acting Department of Revenue Commissioner. Mitchell is now set to replace Angela Rodell, who was fired by the Permanent Fund Board last year. An investigation found that the board used a deficient performance evaluation process, but that a loss of confidence was reason enough to fire her. It also found no credible evidence that Dunleavy was involved in her firing. Alaska law enforcement seized almost 2.5 million fatal doses of fentanyl this summer, part of a statewide effort targeting the deadly opioid. Troopers say that's enough to kill every Alaska resident three times. Alaska state troopers announced the seizures at a news conference today and said the sweep also included 25 arrests since May. Trooper Captain Andrew Gorn says much of the seized fentanyl came from Mexico. The largest seizures took place in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Ketchikan, and Kodiak.
Just one pill containing fentanyl can kill the average person. And it's because of that fact, that unfortunate fact, that I'm confident in our efforts this past summer that we have absolutely saved Alaskan lives.
Public Safety Commissioner James Cockrell says a spring gathering to discuss fentanyl cases in the Matanuska-Susitna borough highlighted the drug's toll on young Alaskans.
It was a very heartfelt press conference with a lot of emotions, meeting with the families that actually lost loved ones, just as I did. I lost my son to a drug overdose in the state of Pennsylvania.
Also seized were roughly 130 pounds of heroin, meth, and cocaine. Still to come in Alaska News Nightly, a new fictional TV show set in Alaska has roots in reality.
There's times where you think, boy, you couldn't make this up. And so I don't know that this fiction is stranger than truth. It's just different.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine and make sure to have an updated COVID-19 booster. Help keep your friends and family protected and healthy this winter. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A new TV show debuts this week centered on a daily newspaper in Alaska and the lives and work of its staff. It's called Alaska Daily, and while the newspaper itself is somewhat based on the Anchorage Daily News, with the show's plot apparently focusing on many real-life themes familiar to Alaskans, the ADN's editors are quick to point out that the show is fiction. That said, the Daily News has been collaborating with ABC to create Alaska Daily, and the show came about after the ADN's Lawless series on sexual violence and failures in Alaska's criminal justice system, which went on to win a Pulitzer Prize. The ADN's lead reporter on the Lawless series, Kyle Hopkins, is an executive producer on the show, and Hopkins says the show's creators have taken a keen interest in creating an honest portrayal of journalists and local journalism in Alaska. Hopkins says they even built a set of a newsroom that was very similar to that of the Anchorage Daily News.
There's just like this building in Vancouver that used to be like a bank vault. And so you go down into this like bunker and there's just this like whole newsroom that looks, I mean, it looked a lot like the Daily News newsroom at the time. And there was like a, there was like an editor's office, right? Where like, I literally did, you know, cause I was still working. So like I did actually do some work in that newsroom cause it like in between, you know, like takes and stuff.
You did newspaper reporting work in the newsroom that was created for the TV show, but you were working for the real Anchorage Daily News, obviously.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
A little. Well, we just need a place to work, right? I just need a desk.
Well, I should probably back up. What is it about? What, I mean, in a nutshell, like what is this whole show about?
I feel like the most important thing to communicate is like it's fiction, right? You know, like the director and writer of the show, you know, the creator of the show, Tom McCarthy, he made the movie Spotlight in 2015, which was, you know, that was about an actual series of stories that the Boston Globe team wrote about the Catholic Church, right? And it was kind of retelling how those stories were reported and told. And this is not that, you know, this is not telling how I or anyone else at the paper like reported a specific story. You know, there's commonalities with things that we report on and there's like touchstones and stuff, but it's like, it's fully fictional in the way that like, you know, you have like ER or like, I mean, I don't know, like it's some show about firefighters in a firehouse or whatever. It's a fictional workplace drama that is very much like shares a lot in common with the Anchorage Daily News. And it's meant to kind of be about how like local news is made. I mean, you know how it is, like the stories that we cover are, there's times where you think, boy, you couldn't make this up. And so I don't know that this fiction is stranger than truth. It's just different in this case.
Yeah, totally. Well, for you, why make this show? Why be involved in this at all?
Well, you know, I certainly did not expect to be. You know, I had been thinking about a couple different types of projects. I was really interested in the future of Alaska. Like, what does this place look like 50 years from now? You know, I think we really should be thinking about that. But at the time that we were talking about doing a larger project, you know, it was around the time that Ashley Johnson Barr was killed in Kotzebue. I had written a couple of stories about the police in Nome not following up on reports of sexual assault. And so we did a call out to readers saying, hey, you know, would you be willing to talk to us or help us understand, you know, this issue of sexual violence in Alaska? And the call out got many, many responses. You know, we heard from many, many people, and they would flag like these really specific problems that seemed fixable. And so that was appealing, this idea that like, all right, you know, like there are things that are broken that seem fixable. So we did that project with ProPublica. And after the story started to publish, I started getting all these inquiries, right, about film and TV rights. And I'd gotten that a few times before and kind of never really paid attention to it. But this was like really, it just kept happening and happening. That was a little scary to me because it's like, this is a, you know, these themes are like really delicate. And if anything gets made, my feeling at the time was like, probably nothing will ever get made. But if anything gets made, I want to make sure that like whoever is in a position to make it is like kind of the best possible, you know, folks to come and be doing that. Right. At the time, I had a mentor at ProPublica. He's like, well, you just kind of talk to people who know this world. And so he put me in touch with people who then put me in touch with a few different like creators. And one of them was Tom McCarthy. And we spoke. I was, you know, like a lot of reporters, I was a big fan of Spotlight. It seemed like someone who really wanted to understand or did understand some of the nuances of reporting. Cause it's like, they do all this boring stuff in that movie. You know, they're just like looking at paperwork and they're kind of doing this, like what seems like pretty mundane reporting to get the big story. And I thought that was just a nice treatment. And so, you know, we talked and all the stories I'd heard is like lots of things get talked about, but nothing ever gets made. So I thought, well, that's probably the last I'll hear of that. And then they filmed the pilot and I was like, huh, that seems like a big investment, you know, but then it still seemed like it wasn't going to happen. And then just in the spring, it was like, hey, this is happening. And it all kind of happened pretty quickly. It's been it's kind of head spinning.
Well, So I have to ask the question. I mean, you flew away to go help work on the show and you came back. I don't know if any of that work overlapped with like the stars in the show, but did you ever get a chance to like meet any of them, like Hillary Swank or anybody else?
You know, I was there when the pilot was filmed, so I kind of met everybody during the pilot filming. And, you know, the show's mostly filmed in Vancouver, and the show is being written in New York. And so, you know, like it was a lot of Zoom calls, and you would have individual actors would often call. This has happened a lot. Like, you know, an actor would call and they'll just be like, hey, you know, if you're working on this type of story and you're going into this type of interview, it's, you know, it's the first time you're interviewing the candidate, or it's the, you know, it's like this type of kind of sort of confrontational interview, right? Like, you know, how does that work? So like, we'd have these like long conversations about, well, this one time this happened, or here's what I was thinking about, or whatever. So like, I talked to some of the cast members a lot, the ones who play the reporters. I met Hillary Swank. I met her. She's got a cute little dog. She's like, always has dogs with her.
I got to ask about that. But it is super interesting that any of them would have called like for advice, like almost like a rookie reporter would have called like, hey, how do I deal with this situation? Because so much of that is like your demeanor and how you approach the subject. And
yeah, no, they take it really seriously. The cast, I think, I mean, what do I know, right? But I really like the cast. I think it's a really good cast, you know, it seems like it. And I think people who work in newsrooms will kind of recognize some of the types of people, you know, like no one's based on any one person, but like, there's like definitely like archetypes of like, okay, I've worked with that dude, you know, in every newsroom, yeah. There's that dude.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Kyle Hopkins talking about the new show, Alaska Daily, that airs Thursday on ABC and streams Friday on Hulu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, overlooking the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks, with 400 guest rooms and 17,000 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com. NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
The University of Alaska has responded to an unfair labor practices complaint filed by the union that represents its faculty and filed its own complaint. The University Administration and United Academics, or UNAC, have been trying to work out a new 3-year faculty contract for over a year. UA Associate Vice President of Public Affairs Robbie Graham says filing the complaint was necessary to draw an overall picture of the negotiation process.
Not only for the labor relations agency, but for the public, because it is confusing and it is complicated. We thought that responding to the union's ULP was limiting, because we could only respond to the scope and the content of their filing. And the university's filing provides a greater context for the entire negotiation process.
The two sides are in federally mediated negotiations and have accused one another of dragging out the bargaining process. The university's complaint characterizes the union as obstructionist. Graham points to what the filing describes as surface bargaining.
Not coming to the table in a serious manner. So, for example, UNAC canceled meetings, ended bargaining sessions early, cut the cadence of the meetings in half, withheld introduction of articles, meaning the issues to be negotiated, and delayed the start of the mediation process in general.
In May, the university declared talks at an impasse and imposed a new contract. Those were unilateral actions the union contests. Faculty Union President, University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Abel Bult Ito said by email that last week's filing by the university was expected and, quote, generally a misrepresentation of the facts. Bult Ito added that the union has provided a package of 7 remaining articles, including pay and benefits, for consideration by the university, and is hopeful an agreement can be reached at the next mediation session October 10th. Graham, with the university, says it is also committed to the process and getting to an agreement. A Department of Defense grant will pay for extension of power lines to the Army's Black Rapids Training Center on the Richardson Highway. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, connecting the Northern Warfare Training Facility to grid power is important to U.S. Army Alaska, which plans to use the center more to prepare soldiers for Arctic operations.
The Alaska Energy Authority and Golden Valley Electric Association have been awarded a $12.7 million DOD grant to extend power distribution lines from where they currently terminate outside Delta Junction, 34 miles south to the Army's Black Rapids Training Center. Golden Valley External Affairs Director Meadow Bailey says GVEA and the Army have talked about the project for a long time.
So by being able to work with the Alaska Energy Authority and submit this grant, this was kind of a win-win for everybody that was involved.
Bailey says GVEA has to complete design work and permitting applications and get permission to proceed from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska before construction can start next spring. U.S. Army Alaska Operations and Maintenance Chief Jennifer Meyer says Black Rapids has long relied solely on diesel generators for electricity.
And so in an effort to also reduce our fossil fuels, this was a project that made sense to not only provide both the resiliency and the redundancy, but also to reduce the required maintenance.
Meyer says that's anticipated to cut the Army's operational costs at Black Rapids.
We think that we'll save approximately $24 million over a 25-year life cycle by installing this project as opposed to replacing and upgrading our generators.
The Black Rapids Northern Warfare Training Center is operated by Fort Wainwright to train soldiers in cold weather and mountain warfare. And Meyer says it's expected to get more use.
As the mission in the Arctic continues to grow and be vibrant and come to the forefront.
The distribution line extension is projected to be completed in 2025, and although its primary purpose is to connect the Army's Black Rapids Training Center to grid power, Golden Valley's Bailey says it will also make GVEA service an option for communication sites, residences, and businesses scattered along the 34-mile section of the Richardson Highway.
There's the lodge right near there, so Black Rapids Lodge, of course, and there's also additional military assets along that route. We kind of anticipate, too, that there are some homes and some properties that would be interested in gaining power.
Bailey says the line extension south also brings Golden Valley a little closer to Copper Valley Electric Association lines and the potential of someday connecting the two utilities' grids. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Forest Service plans to use federal infrastructure funds to build new recreation cabins in high-demand areas of the Chugach and Tongass National Forests. The federal infrastructure bill was passed by Congress last year. Last month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said over $37 million will go to national forests so they can build up their infrastructure like campgrounds and cabins. James King is the Forest Service's Director of Recreation, Land, and Minerals for the Alaska region. He says Alaska will get about $14 million to repair existing cabins and build new ones.
We know that cabins are very popular, and we're looking forward to putting cabins where demand exists.
The Forest Service currently has about 200 public-use cabins in Alaska spread between the Chugach and the Tongass. The most popular of the 40 in the Chugach are accessible by trail and are often booked out months in advance. Many can only be accessed by plane or boat. King says it's not often the Forest Service gets to build new cabins.
Simply because most of our cabins are put in remote locations. So by the time shipping and helicoptering and all the transportation logistics are worked out, cabins are pretty expensive to put in location.
He says the Forest Service has a wish list of 50 or so potential cabin locations. This month, they're holding listening sessions to narrow that list down. King says he'd also like to involve local contractors in the building process to boost local economies. A new Coast Guard cutter officially entered service last week after a commissioning ceremony in Ketchikan. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, the 154-foot fast-response cutter Douglas Denman is slated to eventually be homeported in Sitka.
Coast Guard members, their families, and other invited guests gathered on base Ketchikan's pier for the occasion. Ketchikan High School Wind Ensemble welcomed attendees on the misty morning with a rendition of John Philip Sousa's march, The Washington Post. The Douglas Denman second-in-command, Executive Officer Lieutenant Junior Grade Allison Ray, underscored the significance of the event.
Commissioning a cutter is one of the most important traditional milestones in the life of a cutter, as it represents the ship's readiness to conduct Coast Guard operations and her entry into active service.
Like others in its class, the cutter is named after an enlisted member of the Coast Guard who demonstrated exceptional heroism. During the World War II Battle of Guadalcanal, Coast Guard coxswain Douglas Denman remained at his station after he was injured by a bomb dropped by an enemy aircraft. When the order came to abandon ship, Denman carried two of his injured shipmates to the bow and tossed life jackets to comrades struggling to swim in oily water. He was awarded a Purple Heart and a Silver Star for his valor and retired after 2 decades in the service as a bosun's mate. Several of Denman's children and grandchildren made the trip from Georgia to Ketchikan to mark the occasion. Denman's granddaughter, Molly Brooks Barth, was named the ship's ceremonial sponsor. She offered well wishes to the crew at the ceremony.
I truly believe that my grandfather's spirit will be with this crew and all of the crews that will serve aboard it in the years to come.
Vice Admiral Andrew Tiansen, the commander for all Coast Guard operations in the Pacific, formally began the cutter's Coast Guard service.
I hereby place United States Coast Guard cutter Douglas Denman in commission. May God bless and guide this cutter and all who sail on her.
The Douglas Denman's commanding officer, Lieutenant Paul Kang, thanked the vessel's 24 crew members for their dedication. He said they'd endured long, difficult days in the months before the commissioning, including a 35-day trip from Key West to Ketchikan via the Panama Canal.
As we begin our next chapter, operating unforgiving Alaskan waters, I'm confident that we will continue to grow as a crew and a family and earn our title of Grit of the North.
Aboard the ship, that motto, Grit of the North, is posted above doorways and on the ship's crest. Allison Ray, the executive officer, explains.
One of the really cool parts about being the first crew, we were able to design the crest ourselves.
The circular crest, designed in collaboration with a local graphic designer, features a totem pole topped by an eagle holding a salmon. Behind that are the mountains of the ship's eventual home in Sitka. A pair of tridents on either side of the crest honor lives lost at sea. There's Denman's Purple Heart and Silver Star, plus the blue and gold Big Dipper symbolizing Alaska. The new cutter has some advantages over the other two stationed in Ketchikan, an upgraded bow thruster, a new radar system, and a forward-looking infrared camera.
So this, it's kind of neat. At nighttime, we can pretty much see anything as clear as we can in the daytime.
Ray says she's looking forward to getting underway for the Denman's first missions as a commissioned vessel. It'll be tasked with fisheries enforcement, search and rescue, national security, and upholding federal law in Southeast Alaska. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Kirsten Dobrath in Kodiak, Chris Clint in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Eric Stone in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 45 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.